This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines here on Press TV. France reports more than 17,000 new cases of the coronavirus, pushing its total tally to nearly 2.5 million. The UK says it'll prefer to leave the EU with no trade deal rather than compromise its independence, as the two sides remain far apart on a future accord. And people in Sudan hold nationwide rallies calling for change more than a year after a protest movement toppled longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. COVID-19 outbreak in Europe shows no signs of abating as several countries impose new restrictions to curb its spread. France reported more than 17,000 new cases, pushing its total tally now to nearly 2.5 million. Countries introduced nighttime curfews and delayed the reopening of cultural venues to curb the spread. Italy reported over 16,000 new infections and more than 550 deaths. Italy has announced strict restrictions between Christmas Eve and January 6th. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has imposed a lockdown effective immediately on almost 18 million people and reversed plans to ease curbs over Christmas.
First, we will introduce new restrictions in the most affected areas, specifically those parts of London, the South East, and the East of England, which are currently in Tier 3. These areas will enter a new Tier 4, which will be broadly equivalent to the national restrictions which were in place in England in November. That means residents in those areas must stay at home, apart from limited exemptions set out in law. Non-essential retail, indoor gyms and leisure facilities and personal care services must close. People must work from home if they can, but may travel to work if this is not possible, for example, in the construction and manufacturing sectors.
Measures came after the British government said it's dealing with a new coronavirus strain, which is up to 70% more transmissible than that original strain. Now, the number of cases in England has soared in the last couple of weeks because of this virus variant. In Russia now, COVID-19 deaths there surpassed 50,000. Country also recorded over 28,000 new cases on Saturday. News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And today in review, Brexit. Let's go. Prospects of a post-Brexit trade deal between the United Kingdom and European Union remains uncertain at the deadline, as that is the deadline for talks looms. An EU diplomat said that talks remain very blocked amid differences over fishing rights. Another said that Brussels has made London its last offer on the issue. A UK government source said that London will prefer to leave the EU with no trade deal rather than compromise its independence. The official insisted that any trade deal with Brussels has to comply with terms that Britons have voted for. The European Parliament has demanded an agreement by midnight Sunday to review for ratification before the year's end. No deal scenario will mean relying on World Trade Organization rules to govern future trade, which could bring a hike in prices. And joining us now is Keith Pilby, Professor of International Economics and Finance from City University from London, and Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Binary Economics, joining us from London as well. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're both doing well. I guess we'll start with Professor Shakespeare there. Your initial thoughts on the story, please.
If there's no deal, it will be a catastrophe. At this moment, the lorries are piling up, and they will continue to pile up no matter what happens. But the bigger issue is that 45% of our exports, 50% of our imports, are in the free trade area with Europe. And if we go on to these world trade terms, there's a level of tariffs across almost everything. But certain industries will be tariffed, taxed so high that they'll virtually be destroyed, and that includes agriculture and possibly things like cars. Now, we're throwing away our economy, and there will be, on any argument, there will be a loss each year for years and years to come. And this idea of our independence is fantasy. It's bring back the British Empire, and behind it is the economic philosophy of these shriveled maniacs who want basically a very low wage economy in which most people have insecure jobs. Now that is what's going on, and that is what's happened or will happen if there is no deal. And even with a deal, it won't be putting the clock back. It will still be a deal with all sorts of declarations of origin and customs and hold-ups and barriers like that. So there's no deal. It will be a catastrophe.
Thank you, Professor Shakespeare. Professor Pilbeam, pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Now, Keith, if I could ask you, you heard Rodney Shakespeare there, his sense of urgency. You get that same sense of urgency from European Union leaders and the European Commission, the European Parliament. But why do you not get it from Boris Johnson?
Well, I think he's bluffing. At the end of the day, you see, I remember he said this some time ago that, you know, you've got to make the other side think that you will go through with this idiocy, which I agree, it's complete idiocy. You've really got to convince them to get the maximum out of them. And that's his strategy. It's not a very good strategy. It's not an intelligent strategy for business or anything. But that's his strategy. And I've got no doubt he's going to cave in. Because he has to. Because it will be a catastrophe. And it will be clearly pinnable on him and his Brexit cronies, as I call them. Because this is not what people voted for. If they had had this kind of deal, even the deal that he's offering, I don't think it would have had a chance of getting through. It's so far from what he promised. But it's incredible, and it's just incredible that the British haven't yet woken up. But I'm afraid, I agree with your previous speaker, that the day of reckoning is close to him. You know, as they said, the moment of truth is coming, and he's basically lies. And so it is going to be a moment of truth, and they will not be able to hide it behind the coronavirus. In fact, the coronavirus makes the whole situation even worse. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite incredible, this level of incompetence. I've never seen it from the British government ever before.
And come January 1st, Keith, if we do see a no deal take place, what would that mean from that point forward for British industry?
Well, it would mean the end for quite a few industries, even for the fishermen. This is the crazy thing, is that we export most of our fish to the European Union. You couldn't make it up. And they will face tariffs on those fish. And they will lose masses of orders. So you'll have the right to fish, but nowhere to sell it. In fact, the only place you can do is dump it on the UK market at much lower prices. So even the fishermen, but it's such a small part of the British economy that you really do have to wonder if this government's got any responsibility. Because when you're in government, you're supposed to look after the welfare of your citizens. And it seems that this government is incapable of bringing itself to do that. So no, and businesses are screaming out for some sort of certainty. The deal, even the deal that's negotiated, will involve huge amounts of paperwork and customs controls. It's called rules of origin. You see, you can't let American goods into Britain tariff-free and then into European Union tariff-free. Everybody knows this, who knows the first thing about international trade. And it's called rules of origin. And that involves paperwork and inspections and making sure that goods don't leak into the EU. But not one of this was mentioned in the campaign at all. People just dismissed it. Take back control. Well, this is not taking back control. It's risking the whole economy.
And Professor Shakespeare, is it too late to try to clean this thing up in the last week of the year here? Or do you see a crash out with a no deal? And what are the ramifications of that?
First of all, Keith has said it all. And he put his finger on one of the key aspects of even the fishing issue, which is that there will be tariffs on the fish that we sell into Europe. Now, I won't go into it, but there's clearly there is room for solving that particular one. Are you asking me whether there's going to be a deal? There's madness. Behind it is a fantasy of bring back the British Empire, and I can't get rid of it. I said they're swivel-eyed maniacs. That's what seems to be going on. But we will find out. However it happens, there will be the hold-ups and the blockages and the difficulties as set out by Keith. And it's just a question of whether it will be bad or whether it will be completely and utterly catastrophic.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe until we speak to both of you again. That was Professor Keith Pilbeam joining us from London and Professor Rodney Shakespeare joining us from London as well. That's a wrap for this segment of Europe News Review. Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now. Sudanese protesters have hit the streets of the capital, Khartoum, and several other cities calling for change. The protesters are unhappy with the transitional government, accusing it of failing to meet their demands. They say that the government has been too slow getting things done and even neglected reforms it promised. Protesters say they want the formation of a transitional parliament to pass the necessary laws to build a democratic state. They also are demanding justice for those killed during the uprising, which began 2 years ago, which led to the ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April of last year. It also led to the formation of the current transitional government made up of civilian and military rulers. Political analyst Abiyomi Ezekwe says the Sudanese are protesting because the country's economy is not improved after Bashir's ouster.
We also had the formation of a sovereign council. This took place during 2019. Yet there are differences within the council. The council is chaired by the military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Yet the civilian components of this sovereign council are represented by the Forces for Freedom and Change, as well as other coalitions, are now satisfied with the role of the military, particularly in regard to its economic interests, and also a number of executive orders that have been issued absent of any real discussion over the political dynamics within the country at this time. People are out demonstrating because they feel that they have not gained the economic elevations, the economic remedies that they demanded 2 years ago in terms of reduction of prices, jobs, and opportunities for young people in the Sudanese economy.
Children and women in Yemen continue to suffer from health insecurity amid ongoing war and blockade on their country. Paired newborn conjoined twins in Yemen are now in immediate need of treatment abroad due to lack of resources in Yemen.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabain hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing, and Sana'a airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Lebanese police have clashed with students protesting a hike in tuition fees following a decision by top universities to adopt a new dollar exchange rate. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse protesters near the entrance of one of the universities in the capital, Beirut. Angry students responded by throwing water bottles and other objects at riot police. Some protesters also torched dumpsters to block the streets and vandalized banks before being dispersed by security forces. Protests call for affordable education comes amid Lebanon's worst economic crisis since 1975. Country's nosediving currency has led to severe hike in prices. UN says more than half of Lebanon's population is now living below poverty line. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, the first major electoral process after the abrogation of Kashmir's special status has been wrapped up. Elections were held amid tight security with fears of attacks by pro-independence fighters. The results of the elections will be announced on the 22nd of December. And our correspondent Shahana Butt has your latest.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir, held in eight phases, have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of them told Press TV that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man. In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set pay requisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance, and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval, or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the eight-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy, actually without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told the Climate Ambition Summit more must be done to hit net zero emissions. Governments around the world should all declare a state of climate emergency until the world has reached net zero carbon dioxide emissions, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told a summit of world leaders. At least 38 countries have already declared such a state of emergency, often owing to their vulnerability to the impact of climate breakdown, which are already being felt. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, UN Secretary General Urges All Countries to Declare Climate Emergencies. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told the Climate Ambition Summit more must be done to hit net zero emissions. Governments around the world should all declare a state of climate emergency until the world has reached net zero carbon dioxide emissions, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told a summit of world leaders. At least 38 countries have already declared such a state of emergency, often owing to their vulnerability to the impact of climate change, which is already being felt. Can anybody still deny that we're facing a dramatic emergency? Antonio Guterres said on Saturday. I urge all others to follow. Declaring an emergency would require countries to step up their actions on greenhouse gas emissions urgently. An increasing number of governments have a target to reach net zero emissions by around the mid-century. But few have detailed plans on how to achieve that. Many countries are also pouring money into high CO2 activities as they strive to recover from the coronavirus crisis and from economic recession. Antonio Guterres noted that the group of 20 industrialized countries and emerging industries, G20, were spending 50% more in their stimulus packages on fossil fuels and CO2-intensive sectors than they were on low CO2 energy. This is unacceptable, he told the online Climate Ambition Summit, co-hosted by the United Nations, Britain and France. The trillions of dollars needed for COVID recovery is money that we are borrowing from future generations. This is a moral test. We cannot use these resources to lock in policies that burden future generations with a mountain of debt on a broken planet. More than 70 world leaders, civil society activists, business chiefs, and city mayors are attending the Climate Ambition Summit, which marks 5 years since the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. under the Paris Agreement, countries are bound to keep global temperature rises well below the 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels that scientists regard as the outer limit of safety, with an aspiration to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which should avoid the worst of the ravages of climate breakdown. However, the commitments to reduce carbon dioxide emissions that countries made at the Paris Climate Summit were insufficient and would result in catastrophic heating of more than 3 degrees Celsius. The agreement contains a ratchet mechanism by which nations must update their commitments every 5 years. The first deadline is now looming on 31st of December, and at Saturday's summit, world leaders are supposed to come forward with strengthened plans called Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, to cut carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. Britain has come forward with a goal of cutting emissions by 68% by 2030, compared with 1990 levels. The European Union on Friday confirmed its pledge of a 55% cut in carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. Many other countries, including China, Japan, and South Korea, have come forward with longer-term goals of reaching net zero emissions by 2050 or 2060. The United States is not represented at the summit, which was only open to countries willing to make strong new commitments. However, President-elect Joe Biden has signaled his intention to push forward with the Paris Climate Accord, pursue a green recovery from COVID, and reach net zero emissions. Australia, Brazil, Russia, and Saudi Arabia were all excluded from speaking, among others. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged on Friday to end UK taxpayer-funded support for fossil fuel projects overseas after months of pressure from green campaigners. About £21 billion of such funding had been provided in the last 4 years. The summit is a staging post towards the vital UN COP26 talks, aimed at putting countries on track to meet the obligations of the Paris Climate Accord. The COP26 talks will be hosted by Britain in Glasgow next November, after they were postponed this year owing to the coronavirus pandemic.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس ويكون الرسول عليكم شهيدا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of Qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inside this discussion, makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have made you a middle, a balanced nation. Allah has planned in the way that Rasul is shaheed for us, he's a witness for us, and by following him, and in particular by making sure that we don't go to any extreme, then we become example for other people. This shows how balance is important. Among many other qualities, Allah says this is one of the central and fundamental qualities. I decided to read a few hadiths about this important point, and I hope inshallah we all rationally follow this discussion. You know, I am very worried that people, you know, may sometimes misunderstand this important point, but I have responsibility to say this, you know, anyway. Imam Reza alayhi salam, in his famous hadith to Ibn Shabib, you must have heard part of this hadith because frequently mentioned about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ya Ibn Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Husayn. فَبْكِ لِلْحُسَيْنِ ابْنَ عَلِيهِ فَإِنَّهُ ذُبِحَ كَمَا يُذْبَحُ الْكَبْشِ. O son of Shabib, if you are going to cry for anything and for anyone, try to cry for Husayn ibn Ali. That is the most important thing for which you can cry. Even if you have sometimes, you know, personal problems, or, you know, if you lose your dear ones, still, it's better to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Even if you cry for that person, somehow connected to the cry for Imam. Alhamdulillah, we have this habit in community that when we lose someone, we have funeral, we mention the musibah of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Why? Because Imam was killed in a very brutal way. فَإِنَّهُ ذُبِحَ كَمَا يُذْبَحُ الْكَبْشُ. I cannot translate that. It's very painful. وَقُتِلَ مَعَهُ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ ثَمَانِيَةَ عَشَرَ رَجُلًا. And 18 men of Ahlul Bayt, out of 72 or some 70, 18 were from Ahlul Bayt. They were killed. مَا لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ شَبِيهُونَ. None of these 18 had similars in the world. You could not find anyone like those 18. You couldn't find anyone like Abul Fazl, anyone like Ali Akbar, anyone like Ali Asghar.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Then Imam continued and reached this point. Yabna Shabib, in sarraka an takuna ma'ana fi darajat al-ula min al-jinan. If it makes you happy to be with us in the highest levels of heaven, fahzan lihuznina wafrah lifarahina. Try to be sad and to have grief for our sadness and grief, and try to be happy for our happiness. Because when you love someone, then automatically when that person is happy, you feel happy. And when that person is sad, you feel sad. It's natural. I cannot love you and when you suffer, I feel, you know, relaxed. In some other lectures, I have explained that especially this is true about sadness. The unity that is established between two people who share happiness is much weaker than the unity which is needed when two people share sadness. You know, sometimes a person has a birthday party. They invite you, you go there and you are happy. You don't know that person, you don't have that much affinity. But to smile, to laugh, to eat cake together, it's not difficult. I can, you know, share this experience with many people. But someone says, my father has passed away, please, you know, come to the funeral. Then, can you easily cry for him? No, it's not easy. You only cry for that person if your heart is really united with that person and you feel that his musibah is your musibah, his suffering is your suffering. This sympathy is based on strong unity, which cannot be tested when you smile together, when you celebrate together. So the power of crying and sadness and grief is much more than being happy. You know that there are some communities, you know, some sects in Shia Islam, they don't have any sad occasion. You know, the Ismaili community, they only celebrate happy occasions for Ahlul Bayt, only birth anniversaries. Maybe there are exceptions, I don't know, but as far as I know. And I asked one of them, what is the reason for that? Why you don't, you know, commemorate the tragic events? And he explained that, you know, we want to, you know, be happy and we want to, you know, celebrate their happy occasions. And, you know, he said things that, in my understanding, I don't want to judge and I don't want to blame anyone, but in my understanding was not convincing. I think that is not enough to say, you know, we want to, for example, you know, remember their birth, you know, get lesson from their life. You know, something he said, you know, for us, their life is more important than death, you know, something like this. I think it's not enough. This is just one side of the picture. We need to remember their happy occasions and their sad occasions. And in particular, we have to be able to mourn for their suffering and to have pain for their suffering, because we are one family. We are united.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say. Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By handing out masks late, forcing detained people into close quarters, refusing to release the medically vulnerable, not reporting infections, testing inadequately, frequently transferring detainees and pressuring staff and guards to continue working despite compromised health, USICE's handling of the pandemic has led to over 7,000 reported positive cases and at least 8 coronavirus-related deaths among detained people, says John Washington, writer, in an article published under the heading, USICE Mismanagement Created Coronavirus Hotbeds of Infection in and Around Detention Centers. Stay tuned for the details of this article. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's response to the COVID-19 pandemic has been a horrifying and avoidable calamity. By handing out masks late, enforcing detained people into close quarters, refusing to release the medically vulnerable, not reporting infections, testing inadequately,
frequently transferring detainees and pressuring staff and guards to continue working despite compromised health, ICE's handling of the pandemic has led to over 7,000 reported positive cases and at least 8 coronavirus-related deaths among detained people. A new report from Detention Watch Network finds that the dire situation inside also led to wider consequences. When a spread in the communities surrounding detention centers is included, ICE's sprawling incarceration system added nearly 250,000 cases to the total U.S. caseload. The WN report, Hotbeds of Infection, released recently, lays bare how ICE's abundant failures and dilatory mismanagement killed and infected people inside detention centers and significantly contributed to the spread of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. By August 1st, almost 5.5% of total U.S. cases, according to the report, were attributable to spread from ICE detention centers. The report is yet another damning indication that ICE's dereliction in protecting basic human rights, grievous medical neglect, and lack of transparency in how it detains and treats people in its system of over 200 detention centers is a massive public health threat, both to detainees and the greater U.S. population. The impact of ICE's failure to adequately respond to the pandemic was far-reaching and multi-layered, the WN report says. Even as COVID-19 cases have surged across the U.S., ICE has ramped up enforcement activities, creating a recipe for disaster for those in detention and surrounding communities. The report's authors were at pains to explain that it is not immigrants who spread disease, but rather the immigration detention regime, the nature of incarceration and all it entails, that forces disease and sickens migrants and communities alike. It is setting up ideal lab conditions for incubating viruses and putting them out into the community, said Gregory Hooks, a professor of sociology at McMaster University and co-author of DWN report. Dr. Ranit Mishori, a Georgetown University School of Medicine professor and senior medical advisor at Physicians for Human Rights, said, "The United States has a long history of scapegoating immigrants for the spread of infectious diseases, yet medical evidence suggests that punitive immigration enforcement, such as packing detention facilities or scaring immigrants away from accessing medical care, is the true threat to the public health." Danielle Bennett, an ICE spokesperson, told The Intercept that since the outbreak, the agency has taken extensive steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of testing, cohorting, and medical isolation. Between May 1st and August 1st, the DWN report found ICE detention facilities were responsible for over 245,000 COVID-19 cases throughout the U.S. If a separate country had reported the number of COVID-19 cases attributed just to ICE detention facilities at that point, it would have ranked 16th in the world, having a higher case rate than Germany, France, and Canada. The infection rate inside immigration detention centers was 13 times higher than that of the general U.S. population, which would have, taken together, made them by far the most contagious country in the world, according to the World Health Organization stats. Hotbeds of Infection takes advantage of county-level data on coronavirus infections made available by the New York Times. The authors examined links between IC detention facilities and confirmed cases of COVID-19 in nearby counties. Focusing on initial spread of COVID-19 and based on logistic regression modeling, the report provides evidence that COVID-19 arrived sooner. In April and May, and outbreaks were more severe in counties with ICE facilities as well as in neighboring counties. Over the summer, there was a sharp contrast between counties situated in multi-county economic areas with a high number of people detained by ICE and counties situated in areas with fewer people detained. As the pandemic spiraled out of control over the summer, the healthcare system in economic areas with a significant ICE presence were burdened by thousands of additional COVID-19 cases. Recognizing that other factors besides the presence of detention centers contribute to increased COVID-19 cases, the authors included a range of control variables, including but not limited to the presence of nursing homes, meat packing plants, other high-density living quarters, including prisons, military bases or universities, population density, and the percentage of non-white populations who continue to suffer the worst of the pandemic. After taking into account these other variables, the analysis showed a statistically significant relationship between the presence of an ICE detention center and the exacerbation of the COVID-19 outbreak in the surrounding multi-county area. The advocacy group Freedom for Immigrants reports that over half of immigration detention centers in the U.S. are currently reporting coronavirus outbreaks. According to WN report, California, Texas, and Arizona had by far the most COVID-19 cases resulting from the presence of ICE detention facilities. ICE wasn't only responsible for imperiling people detained and for spreading the virus to surrounding communities. It was also spreading the virus abroad. By continuing deportations, even while the U.S.-Mexico border was almost completely shut down for migrants and asylum seekers, ICE exported the virus to Guatemala, Haiti, Mexico, El Salvador, and India, all countries with few intensive care beds, few respirators, and relatively meager health systems, particularly vulnerable to viral spread. Last spring, at one point, people deported from the United States made up as much as 20% of all known COVID-19 cases in Guatemala. In 2020 fiscal year, ICE deported 164,455 people from the U.S., potentially sending thousands or even tens of thousands of cases throughout the world. Attorneys, advocates, detainees, and even judges began sounding the alarm about COVID-19 cases in immigration detention system in March, but ICE failed to heed the calls to take significant preventive measures. Early on the pandemic, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that ICE was not providing detainees with proper information about the coronavirus. The Intercept reported that a detention center in Georgia, while engaging in a host of medically dangerous practices, was ignoring and underreporting coronavirus cases. In April, a federal judge ordered ICE to consider a release of all detainees over the age of 55 due to risks from coronavirus, ruling that ICE has shown medical indifference and put people with serious medical conditions or disabilities at substantial risk of harm. Overall, though, very few people were released. Thousands got sick. Meanwhile, medical staff, administrators, vendors, visitors, and guards have been bringing the virus into detention centers across the U.S. and carrying out the virus out, with ICE doing little and sometimes nothing to contain the spread on both sides of the bars. Immigration detention centers, the report grimly notes, have been among the deadliest of public institutions during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. immigration detention system has a history of medically neglect, dehumanizing, squalid, and sometimes deadly conditions, including previous viral outbreaks that far predate the COVID-19 crisis. Just in fiscal year 2020, a total of 20 people died in ICE detention centers. For years, experts have repeatedly condemned the agency for violating basic health standards, keeping detained people locked up for prolonged periods, abusing them, even torturing them, and placing them at high risk for mental and physical decline. In 2019, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform and its Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties began investigating troubling report of in-custody deaths of adults and children, as well as deficient medical care, improper treatment, and filthy conditions at facilities operated by both ICE and Customs and Border Protection and other immigration enforcement agency under the umbrella of Department of Homeland Security. They found a widespread failure to provide necessary medical care to detainees with serious and chronic medical conditions, along with critical medical staff shortages. The conditions, in other words, were perfect for a rapacious virus to take hold. Hotbeds of infection is the first report to build on the investigations into the dangers within detention centers and looks closely at the risks they pose to communities where they are located. Evidence points to detention centers sparking infections early in the pandemic and making outbreaks worse, the report says. The multi-county area surrounding detention centers with the highest number of people detained saw a 20% increase in COVID-19 caseloads. Hooks, the report co-author, said, "I think of prisons and detention centers as ongoing super spreader of events."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.